Welcome to Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason.
And I'm Peter.
We've got a great show for you today. Our guest is Helga Hayes. Helga's going to be talking about the concept of financial intimacy.
I got to hear a sneak preview of that program, and I have to say that women in particular are going to find that to be a valuable discussion because Helga has had experience in having to take over family finances on short notice at the death of her husband. And I personally have always believed that men should be able to cook and women should know something about money so that we can survive and not have to go through the emotional trauma when something unexpected happens.
You can find links to more information about Helga and financial intimacy on our website at www.promoneytalk.com. But first, let's talk about what's been in the news. Peter, what do you have for us?
Well, I think an important thing happened a couple of weeks ago that it did make the news, but maybe the significance of it hasn't been clear to investors. Okay. I'm talking about the revaluation of the Chinese currency, which is sometimes called the yuan or the renminbi. China has held its currency steady in value compared to the U.S. dollar for some time. And as we've been buying more and more goods, they've been able to keep the prices lower because they're keeping their currency artificially low versus the dollar.
Can you explain that a little bit more? How does the Chinese currency being linked to the U.S. currency affect prices?
Well, when a currency is held artificially low, the price of goods for someone else who has a different currency is held artificially low also.
Okay.
So, for example, these aren't real numbers, but let's say that you could get 10 or you could buy 10 yuans with $1. Then if something was priced at 1 yuan in China, which might be expensive to them, it would appear cheap to us.
I see.
And normally these things balance out over time. As we would buy more goods, we'd be buying more of their currency, which would make it the demand would be up and the price of the currency should rise, all things being equal. And as more dollars flood the market, the dollar would become cheaper and everything would balance out in the long term. But China's been very aggressive in trying to grow their economy and pull people out of the sort of backward agricultural type of culture that they have and adding to their manufacturing and so on. So it's been hurting U.S. exports because our goods are relatively expensive and theirs are cheap, and it's certainly helped their exports quite a bit. One thing that people don't point out often is that that actually has benefited us in the sense that consumers here have been able to buy goods very cheaply, which is actually a benefit to us.
Right.
But this imbalance was getting on the nerves of the government here and the manufacturers, unions, and so on, because we really weren't able to compete fairly in their markets.
Mm-hmm.
So over time, they've accumulated $700 billion in currency reserves. And what they have done with those is they've invested a lot of them in U.S. treasuries, in U.S. treasury bonds, which also has been good for us in the sense that by buying the bonds and pushing the prices of the bonds up through that demand, the relative yields of the bonds has been able to stay at a relatively low level.
Okay.
So it's a little confusing up and down, back and forth, but the idea is they've held their currency cheap. They've earned a lot of dollars. They've been pouring the dollars back into U.S. treasuries, and that has kept long-term interest rates low in our economy for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, the Federal Reserve has been trying to increase rates to slow the economy down, and they've been raising the short-term rate, which is the only one that they actually work with, the overnight rate of lending between banks. But they have not been able to have any impact on longer-term rates because of this foreign influx of money into treasuries.
I see.
It's really a market for those bonds that determines the rates, the number of buyers and sellers. So it's been good for us in terms of keeping interest rates low, mortgages cheap, borrowing relatively inexpensive, and a lot of Americans have benefited by refinancing their mortgages and easily spending money.
Let me ask you a quick question here. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship between bonds and my mortgage or me borrowing money?
Thanks for stopping me. I assume that people understand some of these links, and I appreciate the question. Mortgage rates are, fixed mortgage rates, I should say, are pegged to the 10-year U.S. Treasury. So normally the lenders are adjusting the fixed rate mortgages, the 30-year mortgage and the 15-year mortgage, to the rate on the 10-year Treasury. It's going to be slightly higher than the U.S. Treasury, but it's going to move pretty much in lockstep with it. So that 10-year Treasury is what the Chinese have been buying, keeping the interest rates low, keeping our mortgages low.
So you're telling me that when we hear about the Fed raising interest rates a quarter of a percent, that doesn't mean that my mortgage is going up or that new mortgages go up a quarter percent.
That's right. Mm-hmm. The short-term rates and the long-term rates are somewhat related, but they're not in lockstep with each other.
I see.
And Chairman Greenspan commented recently in testimony before Congress that there was this conundrum, this puzzle. Why were they raising the short-term rates and long-term rates weren't going up? I think the Asian, Japanese and Chinese have been buyers of treasuries are a big part of the answer to that question. So it's been great as long as they wanted to buy our treasuries and keep our interest rates low and allow for the financing of the government and in turn making it easier for all of us to borrow. But recently they, of course, tried to diversify into buying a U.S. company called Unocal, and right. That raised a lot of red flags and a lot of concern in Washington. We don't want to lose control of the distribution and production of scarce resources. But it's sort of a natural follow-on that when countries accumulate a whole lot of cash of another currency, they need somewhere to spend it, and they naturally go for what seems to have value. So the significance of this revaluation is really more in the long term than what's already happened. On July 21st, China announced their revaluation of the currency, so it no longer was going to be this huge imbalance in the valuations. They were going to allow their currency to float a little bit, in other words, to rise according to market forces, which were trying to push it up, and they were artificially keeping it down. And by the way countries do that is to buy and sell currencies, their own currency and other currencies on the open markets, and it's the old supply and demand equation. If they're buying up the currency, it usually rises in value because it's scarcer, and when they sell it, it's more plentiful and it falls in value. Eventually, they run out of money to do that, but with all of their foreign currency reserves, China was in a pretty good position to be able to control the value of their currency. And our government was trying to jawbone them or talk them into letting it rise a little bit so we could sell more to them. Well, they finally did that on July 21st. They allowed their currency to rise 2.1%, which was a small but I think very significant crack in the dike, a beginning of a process of revaluation.
And from what I understand, how they did this is important as well. Can you explain?
Yes, they didn't disclose exactly how they were going to peg the currency. Obviously, they're still going to control its value. They're not going to let it float freely. But they didn't reveal the secret formula that goes into their recalculation. They did let us know that the currency was going to be pegged to a basket of other currencies instead of just to the dollar. And they let us know that they're going to limit the amount of daily float or change in value to 1/3 of 1%. The important thing is they didn't tell us the details of the formula, and therefore there's no way to really plan or to know what to do with it because we don't really know what it means. They're saying, hey, we're going to do it differently, and they've given us a little peek behind the curtain, but not enough of one to have great certainty. But then a couple of weeks later, they did say, hey, the basket that we're using of currencies is actually the yen, the dollar, the euro, and the Korean won. So what that tells me is that now we're going to see not only a change in the relative value of the yuan or China's currency to the dollar, we're likely to see a rise in other Asian currencies too as the money is shifted. I also think we're going to see further rise in the value of their currency because that's the way the market's trying to push it. People estimate that it might be undervalued by 30 to 40%. So the 2% was a little toe in the door. I think they were trying to psychologically prepare the markets for what was coming. We can all get comfortable so we don't disrupt world trade too much or create too much anger. Because the worst thing that you can have is trade tariffs and barriers and retaliation between countries. When
sure.
when that starts, then you're on the downhill slide to economic warfare, if you will.
So, do you think this is the first step in a long path then of the currency becoming more fairly, if you will, valued? In other words, you see this as a trend; it's going to continue because of the pressure. It's mm-hmm. going to continue to rise.
Exactly.
Okay.
So in the long term, what I think we need to look for is probably higher U.S. interest rates, the longer-term rates we were talking about, right. the 5, 10, 20-year bonds. Incidentally, the other important piece of news that kind of went unnoticed in the last couple of weeks was that the U.S. once again plans to issue 30-year Treasury bonds, which, again, supply and demand, more of them out there, the supply rising, therefore the value dropping.
Okay.
The price dropping, and therefore, because it's a bond, the interest rate rising.
Right.
And so we have a couple of things that are, all things equal, likely to put upward pressure on longer-term interest rates in this country, which may finally get the economy to slow down a little bit. It'll be good in fighting inflation, but it may be the beginning of the end for the housing market bubble, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some areas it is. Also, obviously, we're going to see a lower U.S. dollar. Even if the dollar didn't change value, if the Chinese currency goes up, the dollar is lower by
sure.
definition, yeah, especially relative to Asian currencies.
Okay.
And more to come. So I think we've just seen the start. By the way, on the first day of the revaluation of the Chinese currency, the 10-year Treasury interest rate rose by 0.1%, which actually is pretty significant. That's quite a move in one day. It rose from about 4.1 to 4.2, I believe, percent in one day.
So because the Chinese currency is also being pegged against some of the other Asian currencies, and because some of those Asian countries also hold a lot of U.S. dollars, it's more than just – you think it's more than just it's more than just the effect, the direct effect that China has on us, but the effect that China is going to have in the whole – Asian community in relation to us.
Right. Obviously, they do a lot of trade with countries that are located in close geographic proximity.
Sure.
Similar cultures, similar value systems. And
That brings up a question. Then I hear, and this is getting a little bit off topic, but I hear people talking more and more about investing in up-and-coming regions, up-and-coming countries, and China is obviously one that they talk a lot about. How does this affect the potential returns in investing in China or Korea?
That's a good question. I think it's a healthy move to move more towards market forces. I think there's a move at this point away from national independence economically to regional interdependence, like the European Union, the CAFTA bill that was just passed here in this hemisphere, and there's a group called ASEAN, which is the Asian trade bloc. And so we're all looking for competitive advantage and the strength that comes from finding partners, if you will. And so we have three major trade areas in the world, I think that that's the trend, is towards opening up freer trade, especially within those groups.
Cool. Great. Well, that's big news. And it's big news that's maybe fallen under the radar a little bit, and it sounds like it's going to have a pretty profound effect on our economy for a long time.
They say China's the country of this century, and I think that's true, especially – they've got India over there in, with about a billion people also, with more and more people speaking English and opening up their borders to trade and to stock ownership and so on. So it's sort of a capitalist dream. I'm not sure exporting our culture is a benefit to them, but exporting our capital and our know-how, I think, stimulates the whole world, and a standard of living will rise there, and they'll become greater contributors to the world scene. I also like the fact that with increased trade, we come to understand each other better and become more interdependent and less likely to get at each other's throats or have tensions that could lead to war.
And it makes sense then from that comment that it would benefit investors all over the world as well when we kind of break down these barriers and make money in new areas, if you will.
It provides more opportunities, but also all countries benefit when they participate in freer trade. The standard of living tends to rise. I read somewhere a while back that you could attribute all of the growth in the United States since World War II to free trade, that if we hadn't opened up or international trading, that we might not have had any real growth at all.
Wow.
I don't know if that's an exaggeration, but we spent a lot of time in college economics classes talking about the benefits of free trade. And when you specialize, you do what you do well, and you have that competition, keeps everybody honest and on their toes. It's harder for businesses, but it's great for the consumer.
Well, it's a pretty exciting time, it sounds like, where there's a lot of opportunity going forward, a lot of opportunity and a lot of pitfalls, and that's exciting.
I know a lot of people are concerned about the loss of jobs and staying competitive. I'm sure we can rise to the occasion, and with the global expansion of knowledge and availability of knowledge, there's no reason that we can't take advantage of that engine that we've created. As I say, it's harder for business, and people are going to have to reinvent themselves, and there's a lot of dislocation that goes on. But it's sort of inevitable, and even governments can't stop the tide eventually because it becomes too big a burden for them to stand in the way. So that's the way things are headed.
Well, I bet our listeners will have a lot of questions and possibly comments for us.
Send your hate mail, too.
Don't kill the messenger.
Well, by the way, please withhold the hate mail, but we do have a new email address as well, which is promoneytalk@gmail.com. So if you have a message or a question or a good old success story that we keep fishing for, or if you want to send us an audio comment that we could include in the program, please send it along to promoneytalk@gmail.com.
And we'll get that up, make sure that we get that up on the website as well. You can go to www.promoneytalk.com and find more information there. Well, coming up next is the interview with Helga Hayes, where Helga discusses the importance of both parties in a relationship having an understanding of their family's finances. Enjoy. Hi, I'm here with Helga Hayes of Financial Intimacy. You can go to our website at www.financialintimacy.com to learn more. Helga, I really like the term financial intimacy. What do you mean by financial intimacy?
Well, financial intimacy really means financial transparency. Based on the definition of intimacy, where you get to know somebody or a situation more deeply, more closely, you get a clearer look at what it is that you'd like to know more about. When you have financial intimacy, you are privy to everything that's going on financially in the marriage on all fronts. And that creates a sense of closeness and a sense of oneness rather than just one person in the marriage taking care of the finances. And typically it is the husband, even after 40 years of feminism, it is still right. The husband who does the finances, sometimes with his wife's knowledge and full endorsement and approval, and sometimes because he just abrogates the responsibility. But sure. The point is, the transparency is what I mean.
So we're really talking about relationships here. We're talking about, you're mentioning marriage, even pre-marriage. We're talking about the relationships between a couple and how finances can, and how finances do come into play and how that can bring a couple closer or how that can create problems. First of all, let me talk about your story a little bit. What made you first become interested in this topic?
I was married to an entrepreneur in a community property state. And every time the company needed money, my husband would come to me and he would say, "Sign here, honey." Mm-hmm. And I would just sign without having a clue as to what I was signing or that I was signing for a business that I didn't understand. And even though it was a really wonderful marriage, there was always this feeling of financial unease. And my husband died in an accident very suddenly 10 years ago. And I had a premonition. I don't understand where I got it, but I just had a feeling even before he died that I needed to educate myself about finances and everything I needed to know in case I needed to manage on my own. And I started to do the research and was appalled at what I learned about what I didn't know.
Right.
And so that's how I got into this. And I had no idea that it would have such an enormous impact on my life to have this information to put my life together after he died.
Well, you talked about finding out about a lot of things that appalled you, a lot of facts about marriage and relationships and finances that you didn't know. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. I learned that that husbands die before their wives, typically. Those are the demographics. That the average age a woman is widowed is 56.
Wow.
That's just very young. The longevity for women today is about 84 years old. And if a woman is widowed at 56 or thereabouts, she may live another 20, 30 years if she hasn't done any financial planning or if she doesn't understand what's involved in her marital finances and she's not protected by some sort of a trust, a revocable trust, and estate planning, then she is likely to wind up poor. And I also learned that married women compared to women who have been widowed are financially much better off. And so that most of the damage that is done for a lack of awareness and communication and ability to understand money.
Well, you're really hitting on a fear that a lot of people have. I know that a lot of women that I've met have a fear, regardless of how wealthy they actually are. They have a fear of becoming a bag lady.
Yes, the bag lady syndrome. And I think that's part of our collective unconscious fear. Mm-hmm. But it really has more to do with this feeling of total isolation and aloneness and not belonging anywhere, not having a home, not having a family that you belong to.
Sure.
But, you know, the fear is an image, but it's so far from the way it has to be.
Right. Well, and we also fear what we don't know. And in this case, what you're saying is a lot of people, a lot of times in a relationship, there's one person who plays the role as a financial professional, if you will, within the relationship. And oftentimes that's the man. And in that case, the woman then doesn't have a lot of knowledge. And so there's fear wrapped around that. And there should be fear wrapped around that because, as you explain in your seminars and on your website, it can cause a lot of damage. On that topic, if you were gonna talk to a bride to be, somebody before they're getting married, what would you tell them that they need to know going into this relationship?
The first thing they need to know is that they need to know. They need to know how to talk about money. Because if they can't talk with their fiancé about money, it's not going to get any easier talking with their husband about money. The second thing they need to know is that money is the kind of the force that drives the real world engine of their marriage. There's the wonderful romance and the love and all the reasons that they get married in the first place. But it's the money that keeps it functioning on a day-to-day basis. And so they need to know about the relationship between assets and liabilities. They need to understand income and expenses. They need to understand debt. They need to know, they need to disclose to their fiancé about their own debt, and they need to know about their fiancé's debt load if he has one, and they need to know each other's FICO scores. I talk to so many young people. Actually, I talk to so many people of all ages who don't have a clue what their FICO score is, and they need to know this, and it's so easy to find out. But if a fiancé won't disclose a FICO score, they're holding something back.
Sure. Well, before we get into the actual married couples and the issues that they deal with, you talked about romance and you talked about finances. And we had a little chat before this show, and we were talking just about that and about the difference between romance and finances and why they should really be kept separate. And I found that fascinating. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Sure. And I think, Jason, that we were talking about the difference between romance and intimacy.
Right.
And I was explaining that from my point of view, romance sets a mood and creates an environment that is geared towards the fantasy, towards setting a certain tone to keep to keep the romance going.
Sure.
Intimacy is almost exactly the opposite, because intimacy, the dictionary definition is getting more in-depth knowledge of something, not creating a smokescreen or creating an environment, but it's the nitty-gritty. It's the way things really are. And the disclosure of that is what creates the closeness. And as I said earlier, the intimacy, the financial intimacy aspect is the financial transparency. And so it's the intimacy that creates the transparency. Romance creates a stage setting.
Right. But you're a believer in both. You're a little bit of a romantic yourself. And we're not saying that there's anything wrong with romance, but that they have their separate places.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's I'm writing a book right now, and one of the chapters I'm working on is money and romance. And it's interesting to note that women have said, oh, it's so unromantic to talk about money.
Right.
Well, absolutely it's unromantic to talk about money, and it's unromantic to talk about the plumbing's not working or the car needs to be fixed or many other mundane topics. Well, you don't always have to have a romantic conversation about things, and there's nothing romantic about money, and it should never even be included in the same sentence.
And what you mentioned before was that when we're in a romantic setting, we shouldn't bring up money.
Absolutely.
Because there's
not
a place for romance, and that should be in its place, and we shouldn't talk about money in that setting.
Absolutely. It's totally inappropriate to raise the topic of money in a romantic situation. If you're in a romantic situation, enjoy the romance. Just abandon yourself to it.
Right.
And the discussion of money is for a different time and a different place.
So now our couple's gotten married and unfortunately didn't take your advice, and they fall into the roles of the man is taking care of the money and the wife is taking care of children. And that becomes a comfortable role. First of all, why don't more wives participate in the finances? Why do we tend to fall into these roles?
Well, sometimes we see it from our parents.
Mm-hmm.
So we just kind of follow the guideline. Sometimes the husband prefers to take on this role, and the wife, who isn't interested in the subject in the first place, just decides to let him.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. I have no problem with that, as long as she is occasionally, once a month, once a quarter, she brings herself up to date on what the financial situation is within the marriage. I think that to just allow one person to have all that responsibility just robs the other spouse of the opportunity to know how well are we doing financially. And many women don't want to know, but the danger that lies within not wanting to know is that if for some reason they do have to cope on their own, then they won't even know where to start because their spouse has been doing everything.
Right. And so that brings us to the consequences of what happens when one partner isn't aware of the finances.
Right.
In your case, there was a death. You were a widow. But also divorce is a fact of life these days.
Yes. And the thing about divorce is that it's very difficult to learn about the finances in a divorce situation because it's an adversarial situation.
Mm-hmm.
When you're trying to get a divorce, everyone's trying to create the kind of picture that's going to yield the most for themselves.
Right.
And so it's very hard to get information at that point. It's much better to stay informed the whole way and not get to that point in the first place. And you never know, you know, one of the statistics that I discovered is that 80% of the divorces are caused by money, inability to correlate money styles, inability to talk about money, inability to control one's own approach to money.
I find that fascinating, but not shocking. I've talked to people who have very different spending habits, very different saving habits, and it can cause a lot of tension in the relationship.
Yes.
So, assuming the situation where the man is in charge of the finances, why should men want their wives to be savvy about the family finances? I mean, it really is a position of power, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it is a position of power, and it's a position sometimes of control. Mm-hmm. But the men who one of the things I did, a survey of the women who had gone through my seminar,
right.
And one of the things that came up repeatedly, 95% of the women who answered positively to the question, my husband was enthusiastic about my wanting to participate in the finances.
Right.
And so we were all surprised
That's
by
great.
That. Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought that was terrific. Yeah, all they had to do was ask. Mm-hmm. And some of the husbands said, what took you so long? You know, 30 years I've had this job, and now, thank goodness, you finally want to know.
Well, it can be a lot of pressure on the person who has the job. That's,
yes.
That's a lot of weight to carry.
Yes, and also they are concerned about how their wife will cope if something happens to them. And they basically really do want the best for their wife, and they want her to listen, and they want her to understand. Mm-hmm. But she has to want to participate, too. She has to take responsibility for this.
And part of not taking the responsibility, Helga's writing a book, and I've been lucky enough to take a peek at the manuscript. And part of not wanting to know there are a couple of things. There's a sense of optimism. There's kind of the hiding your head in the sand scenario. Talk to us a little bit about why people, not just women, but why people don't want to know what's really going on.
Well, there are a few reasons for that, Jason. There is the factor of people think, oh, I won't think about it, and I'll hope for the best. Well, that's really great. That's a terrific attitude, and we all like upbeat people like that, but it has nothing to do with the way the cards play out.
Sure.
Another thing that people do is, and I ran into this with my interviews with men, there's a lot of superstition around this subject of planning for one's own death.
Mm-hmm.
Planning for what would happen, what could happen. And the superstition goes as follows. As soon as I get everything in place, I'm going to die. As though there's some direct connection between God waiting to see that Fred has signed all these papers and now it's bye-bye.
Right.
It doesn't work that way.
No.
And so, but superstition is hard. It's hard to overcome. And one of the things I found surprising is that optimism, which is a wonderful quality to have, optimism does interfere with things when it comes to planning, because it's not just hoping for the best. It's really faulty reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure everything will work out, or I'm praying everything will work out. Sometimes it will, and sometimes it won't. So my best advice is something I call realistic optimism,
okay.
You know. So it's plan. What is that Bible? Forget where it comes from, but it's pray for rain and dig your trenches.
Okay.
So it's do both.
Right.
It's do both. It's be an optimist and know that you've set up everything so that you don't have to worry when you board that plane. You don't have to worry when you go skydiving. You don't have to worry about things that basically. And what I like to say is, the only thing you can control is to plan for the things you can't control. That's all we can do.
What a sense of relief it would be for most people if they knew that they had their ducks in a row, so to speak, that they had their contingencies planned for, mm-hmm. for anything, that their loved ones, their wife, their children were going to be taken care of, mm-hmm. That their wives and children understood the finances, mm-hmm. and were in it. They were putting them in a situation to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does create a peace of mind that you've done what you can. And it's not just doing it and then never revisiting again. People's
right.
circumstances change. And so
sure.
revisit it every 5 years, but keep it up to date so that you know it does truly reflect your circumstances.
So now we've discussed why it's important, certainly, to have both partners in a relationship aware of the financial aspects of their marriage. And you've said that husbands oftentimes are happy when the wife shows an interest. Tell me how wives can initiate the discussion that they want to become aware, more aware of their family's finances.
Well, there are a number of ways in which women can raise the subject. Sometimes when it comes out of the blue, it can be a big shock to someone who's been doing the finances for 30 years. So it's a question of raising the subject with the acknowledgement for your husband. I'm talking now from the woman's point of view.
Sure.
For your acknowledging your husband for having taken care of it for so long and doing such a fabulous job, and you realizing that you really don't know anything about it, and you have heard of other women who have been in this situation, and they have not fared well when something has happened to their husband, and you don't want to be in that situation. It's something that scares you lately. You've been waking up at night thinking about this, and you really wish that you could, if you had known 20 years ago that you really should be involved in it, you probably would have taken action sooner. But here we are 30 years down the road, and I wish I knew. And I'd like to know what we have so that I need to know what our financial situation is. And please take your vitamins because I love you dearly and I don't want anything to happen to you.
That's great. Well, what I really love about this topic is that it's really beneficial for both parties. It's beneficial for the person who's in charge of the finances and unfairly carrying that burden. It's obviously beneficial for the person who doesn't know anything about the finances and who needs to know about it. But it's also beneficial for the relationship. I mean, it really brings people, I can see it really bringing people together. And certainly, as we talked about earlier in the show, with so much stress around money and so many problems around that, I think you mentioned that 80% of divorces had to do with differences in finances. This is really a way to make sure that your relationship stays strong.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Because if someone wants to know about the finances or someone wants to be privy to the records and that information's not forthcoming, there is a feeling of resentment that is built up, and you want to remove as many areas of resentment as you possibly can, because you want basically to affect all the other areas of your marriage in a very positive way.
Now, you gave us a great way for people to initiate this topic between spouses. One thing that I think is kind of funny is you talk about the fact that it's easier to talk about sex than it is to talk about money or death. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, the culture has changed in the last 40 years. 40 years ago, 50 years ago, you couldn't really talk about sex. Now it's become headline news everywhere. But talking about death is still a cultural taboo. Talking about money has always been awkward. Actually, not always been awkward. Probably for the last 50 years, it's become even more awkward because there's a big burden placed on marrying for love. And so when you bring up money in the context of marriage, you bring up death in the context of marriage, you tap into people's most basic fear of dying. And the culture has not come to terms with it, but the culture loves to talk about sex. It's everywhere.
Right.
And women and men go into marriage expecting a really good sexual relationship. And there are sex therapists and all kinds of psychological counseling if a sexual relationship isn't good.
Right.
But we don't have that same kind of counseling to help people deal with their fear about death or their hang-ups about money. And so it's just not culturally acceptable.
And you're really trying to bring that out. You're trying to get the message out to people that it's important for both parties, for both members in a relationship to be aware of finances. And you give, we talked about you're writing a book, but you also give seminars on the topic.
Yeah, I've been giving seminars for women only because I felt that it was very important for them, since they are the ones most often who are not participating in the finances, to understand some of the reasons why they don't participate and teach how to get past that. I was one of those women before this all happened to me. And that's what I'm putting in the book that I'm writing. I'm telling my story and I'm trying to show how taking part in our marital finances helped me become savvy enough to be able to survive after my husband died. And that I don't ever want to see a woman in a situation where she could have planned before and didn't. She didn't take action. And because life is uncertain. What do they say? Life is uncertain. Eat dessert first. Well, this is kind of the dessert that they really should be eating for. And the women have a good time. And I've done, you know, there are certain talks I will give for couples.
Right.
And one of the things that women always say to me is, I wish my husband could hear you. I wish my husband could hear you. So that's why I have broadened the talks for couples. And then the husband can hear me say directly what his wife won't say to him.
Right.
Now, if our listeners want to, some of our female listeners might want to participate in some of your seminars, but I think also a lot of our male listeners may want their significant others to participate in your seminars. They can find information on, where our listeners can find information on Helga's seminars at www.financialintimacy.com. Also, when your book is finished, Helga, you will make it available through your website?
Yes, I will.
Great.
Yes, I will.
Helga, thanks for being our guest today. We really appreciate you coming on the show.
Jason, it was a pleasure. And I really enjoyed the fact that you understand the subject so well.
Well, I'm learning too, but I appreciate it. Thank you.